Today's Tay Show is on case 73 in the Book of Serenity. Case 73 is entitled Kaohsiung's Fulfillment of Filial Piety. Introduction. Lurking in the grasses, sticking to the trees, one turns into a spirit. Being constrained and unjustly punished, one becomes a ghostly curse. When calling it, you burn paper money and present a horse. When repelling it, you curse water and write charms. How can you get peace in the family? A monk asked Kaohsiung, how is it when the mourning clothes are not worn? Kaohsiung said, today Kaohsiung's filial duty is fulfilled. The monk said, how about after fulfillment of filial duty? Kaohsiung said, Kaohsiung likes to get falling down drunk. Verse, the pure household has no neighbors. For long years staying in, sweeping, not admitting any dust, where the light turns, tilts the moon remaining at dawn. When the forms of the hexagram are distinguished, then are established dawn and spring. Having freshly fulfilled filial duty, then one meets spring. Walking drunk, singing crazily, turban hanging down, ambling with tousled hair, who cares? In great peace, with no concerns, a man falling down drunk. So I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning to practice the Great Way, to practice Zen. Many people came here at 7 o'clock, and a rather larger number convened at 8, and even larger number at 9:40, and everybody was sitting very deeply. I can see everybody on the screen, and people were not moving a muscle. And it's really wonderful to practice with all of you. I look forward to seeing you, and I'm so glad that many of you are practicing with great regularity, and that's really wonderful. It's how it's done. So you got up early today to come to practice Zen. Thank you very much for that. So Kaohsiung's Fulfillment of Filial Piety. And probably if you know anything about Chinese culture, you know that in Confucianism, in the teachings of Confucius, it's very important. The idea of family duty is extremely important. Basically, the idea is that your parents gave you your life. Right? They brought you into the world, they worked hard to feed you, they bought you shoes, they bought you clothes, and that, you know, you have an obligation to them for giving you life. They've loved you and cared for you, right? You should treat your parents as the people who brought you into the world with great respect and reverence, right? This is translated, this idea is translated in English as filial piety. In other words, reverence for your parents, reverence for your parents. So there are many ways that people express or manifest filial piety, some spontaneous and some ritualized. One of the ways that people express filial piety is, it used to be the case, I don't know if it's the case anymore, but At one time when people, when your parents died or when a parent died, you would not wear your usual clothes, but you would go to the grave site in mourning, mourning, mourning clothes. And mourning clothes are actually made out of flax. They're made out of very crude flax, or we would say in English, burlap. Burlap is actually flax, believe it or not. Traditionally, people would wear these clothes, sort of coarse clothes made out of flax, and they would go to the gravesite, as I understand it. It was part of your filial duty to wear mourning clothes and go to the gravesite. In this case, a monk comes to Kaoshan and he says, "How is it when the mourning clothes are not worn?" Not worn. Now, ordinarily, we would say that person is not demonstrating filial piety. That person has not demonstrated filial piety by coming to the funeral of a parent in the appropriate mourning clothes, the burlap clothes I spoke about. And we would expect Kaoshan to say, "Oh, that's terrible." Instead, Kaoshan says, "Ah, today Kaoshan's filial duty is fulfilled." So failing to come in mourning clothes is somehow fulfilling your filial duty. Then the monk said, "Well, how about after the fulfillment of filial duty?" And Kaoshan said, "Kaoshan likes to get falling down drunk." Okay, so now you see the hook. Every koan has a hook. It has something that doesn't quite make sense. It's an inconsistency. Normally what we do in our lives is we try to ignore the inconsistencies, right? So, what we as we go through the day, we may experience different kinds of inconsistencies, and generally what we do is we paper them over or we ignore them, right? As much as we can, so that we can stay in our familiar routines. Right? Inconsistencies bother people, right? And they bother us all. And we prefer not to deal with them. Our world, our human world, is profoundly artificial. And it's a kind of collective dream, at least to the Zen way of thinking. When we ignore the inconsistencies, we're actually keeping the unreality of our way of life intact. We're protecting ourselves from waking up to the artificiality of the way we live. People do all kinds of things that really don't make much sense. So for example, I've known people who are like assiduous savers. There are people in my family who have been like assiduous savers. So they save everything, every penny, and they put it away. And they save and they save. My mother had an apartment just full of stuff that she had acquired, and she didn't, it was impossible to get her to give up any of it. If you say to somebody, "Well, why are you saving?" They'll say, "Well, it's for the future." And then, one day, they die. You know, you read about this in the paper. People die and they have $5 million in the bank. And, you know, they were saving for the future. They were saving, imagining that they would do something with all this money in the future. And then saving becomes such a habit in itself, such a goal in itself, that they never have a future, right? You know. So this is maybe not the best example, but you know, we all do things in life that are inconsistent with other values we have, you know, you know, we try to conceal those from ourselves. So you know, what koans do, among other things, is to call attention to some contradiction in the way we live. Another good example would be something like this. I remember when I was I lived in Albuquerque for a while. I had hitchhiked out to Albuquerque, and I was working in an Italian restaurant. And I had just gotten out of college, and I was working at this Italian restaurant, and I had to be at the Italian restaurant at like 8 o'clock in the morning, I think it was. And I would work all morning until noon, and then you had 2 hours off to get some sleep or to rest. And then you would have to be back at like 2, and you would work until 11. That was, and I did that 6 days a week. That's actually a very typical cook's job. And one day after we had finished all our shifts and we were sitting in the bar, unwinding after a very strenuous day, I was talking to the manager of the restaurant, and he was a very conservative, politically conservative person. And he was saying, you know, people in this country are so free. This is the freest country in the world. And his name was Mike. And I said, but Mike, you know, we're not really that free. You know, I'm working an 80-hour week. He said, but you're free to find another job, right? So there's inconsistency there, right? We believe we're free, but we're not, you know, we're free to starve if we don't work an 80-hour week. So at any rate, there's lots of inconsistencies in our way of life. And one of the things koans do is to call attention to like the ways we've papered over our very artificial reality. And this koan is doing that work as well. It's calling attention to something that's contradictory. And in this case, it's saying when you don't wear your morning clothes, you're fulfilling your familial duty. So, somebody wrote me an email, and this is a person who's been practicing really wholeheartedly. This person is new to Zen and has been practicing really wholeheartedly. And the person wrote me a letter, an email, and said, you know, I had a good sit today. When I sat down, I had a lot of problems that I was working on in my job. After two sits, I sort of solved my problems. And the third sit was a little bit harder because I wasn't working on my problems at work anymore. This is a person who has gotten interested in Zen and is using Zen to, you can say, you know, solve problems. And there's nothing, I'm not criticizing this. I'm not criticizing this person. You know, there's lots of books on Zen. There's a wonderful book on Zen called After the Enlightenment, the Laundry, basically. And that's what it's called, After the Enlightenment, the Laundry. Now, what it's saying is the purpose of meditation is to help us deal with our problems in life, right? And there's definitely a truth to that, right? There's definitely a truth to that. So I myself have had situations like this. Something will happen at work, and maybe two people who work for me are both fighting, not getting along, and I don't know how to resolve the issue. And I sit down on the cushion and it keeps coming up and coming up. And after a while, I know what I said, oh, I know. And I've also had cases like this where sometimes I'll be writing something and I'll be stuck. I won't know what to say or what to do. I'll be staring at the paper, at the screen now, for hours, and I won't know where should I go with this? I don't know what to do next. And I'll sit down on the cushion, and sometimes instead of watching my breath or working on my own koan, you could say, I'll be processing this problem. And sometimes I'll be able to construct in my mind the whole argument I need to build on the paper when I get home. And it's possible in that case to say, basically, this Zen is really wonderful. It's helping me to solve my problems, right? So, you can say, well, I didn't know how to finish my essay, and I sat on the cushion for an hour, and suddenly the whole organization presented itself to me. Or there was an artist who came to our sesshin long ago. This was like 20 years ago. And after the sesshin, I said, how did it go? And he said, oh my gosh. He said, before I came to sesshin, I was totally blocked. And he said, but I have filled sketchbooks full of ideas. I have sketchbooks full of ideas. And he was so happy. And somehow the floodgates had opened, and he was filling these sketchbooks with, he had left that sesshin with so many ideas. This is sort of the spirit of after the enlightenment, the laundry. So basically the idea is that the purpose of our Zen practice is to help us get through the day, is to help us accomplish our goals and fulfill our dreams, see. And there is a truth to that. There is a truth to that. But on the other hand, that could be a real problem, believe it or not. When I am using Zen to quote unquote solve my problems, like finish writing my paper, decide how to mediate a conflict among my employees at work. I'm a blocked artist and I suddenly get all these ideas and put them in my sketchbook. Those are all useful and helpful. But, they're not as helpful as they could be. How shall I put it? There was a woman who came to our group long ago. I remember this because she wanted to talk to me. And we sat down and she said, I have just started a business. And I'm overcome with anxiety. And I think Zen will be able to help me. We talked for like an hour. And I said, you've started this business and of course you want it to succeed. And she said, will Zen help it to succeed? And I said, not necessarily. She looked sort of crestfallen. And I said, look, Zen will help you whether your business succeeds or fails. And she definitely didn't like that answer. Right, that was like she didn't want to hear that her business could fail. Right? She wanted me to say, oh yes, if you practice Zen, you will succeed. but, actually, that we say when we recite the verses on the heart mind, we recite some verses. These are the verses we recite in the morning at the beginning of the Saturday events. We recite something called the verses on trust in mind, the Xin Qin Ming or Xin Jin Mei. And these verses were written by one of the great Zen ancestors, Seng Tsang. And in the poem that we recite, there are these lines. The wise man strives to no goals, but the foolish man fetters himself. There is one Dharma, not many distinctions arise from the clinging need of the ignorant. And another place it says, gain and loss, right and wrong, such thoughts must finally be abolished at once. Gain and loss, right and wrong, such thoughts must finally be abolished at once. So, you know, it's definitely the case that meditation can help you with your everyday problems. It can solve mediation problems at work. Sitting on the cushion can help you work through technical, economic, or scientific conundrums that you're working on. But, you know, in a way, that's a terrible waste of your time, you know, of your precious time. You know, what I said to this person was, you have 23 hours a day. If you meditate an hour a day, you have 23 hours a day to worry about mediating the conflict at work. You have 23 hours a day to worry about, how to end your essay. But give yourself 1 hour where that doesn't matter. See? And I think that will be the most valuable hour of the day. Gain and loss, right and wrong, such thoughts must finally be abolished at once. Right? The wise man strives to no goals, but the foolish man fetters himself. So I think this is a really important lesson. You know, I wonder if, you know, I know that in Indian tradition, and in many traditions, Chinese tradition as well, and in ancient European, in ancient, like pre-Christian religion in the West, there was a god of wealth, right? So you would pray to the god of wealth. It's Ganesh in Indian tradition. And believe it or not, it was Pluto in ancient Greek tradition. And there's a Chinese god of wealth too. And if you want wealth, you can pray to the god of wealth. If you want, something else, there is a goddess of wisdom, Sarasvati, and school children will make offerings to the goddess of wisdom, Sarasvati. I wonder if that bothers you. That bothers me somehow. I think that what we're doing is we're taking the universe and shrinking it down to our own image, right? We're taking the infinite universe and we're shrinking it down to our own image. It's like saying, humans have existed, they say, for like 300,000 years. And life on Earth, the Earth is something like 15 billion years old. And it's like saying that all of that 15 billion years of existence, all of it was supposed to lead up to McDonald's or Burger King, right? It's like all those 200, you think of all of our ancestors, the pre-human ancestors, running from whatever, saber-toothed tigers, whatever they had to do. And their suffering and their difficulties, right? And their challenges. And all of that was so you could have it your way at Burger King, right? Or Big Macs with French fries, right? That's absurd. It's absurd to think that way. I remember many, many years ago, watching on TV, there's a sacred mountain in Arizona, and some land speculators had bought part of the mountain, and they wanted to put a ski resort on the mountain. And now listen, skiing is wonderful, don't get me wrong, but they wanted to put the ski resort on the mountain, and then a bunch of, I think they were Pueblo Indians, no, I'm sorry, I think they were Navajo Indians, sued. And they had a big case that was covered in the newspaper. And it was also on like evening news when I was living in that area. And, you know, you had all these people testifying. They showed the plans for the ski resort, and they talked about how much money it would make and so on. And then this spiritual leader of this pueblo got up to speak, and he had a bandana across his forehead, you know, tied around his forehead. He had an old check shirt. You know, this is how Pueblo Indians of that period used to dress. And he got up and he said, you know, he said something that actually, even now, I when I say it, I feel like crying. He said, "These mountains were not made for human foolishness. These mountains were not made for human foolishness." So you know, when we pray to Ganesh, if you pray to Ganesh, please feel free. You know, if you get down on your knees and you say, "Oh Lord, please, you know, let my 401k and not go down the tubes," you know, you're shrinking the universe down to a tiny little thing, right? This infinite unit, and you're shrinking yourself down to this tiny little thing, right? Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't invest wisely. And I'm not saying you shouldn't try to solve your problems. And I'm not saying you shouldn't sometimes on the cushion think about the dispute at work and how you're going to mediate it. So those are not like, I'm not condemning that or saying that's really bad. But what I am saying is that I think that with all due respect, you know, we're losing something really important when we make our practice about things like that. And in a way, you know, we're even losing something important when we make our life primarily about things like that. You know, I was reading yesterday this wonderful article. I don't know if you read Aeon magazine. It's an online magazine of ideas. And there was an article about the great French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre. And I myself loved Sartre when I was young, and I haven't given him that much thought since then. But this guy was talking about the fact that what's happened to us with the COVID-19 lockdown is very similar to what happened in Paris when the Nazis invaded France. And he said, of course, it's not a military occupation, but it's like our familiar way of living has been totally stopped. And now we're sort of like stuck in our houses, we can't go to the movies. And he said he started by saying there are these similarities between then and now. And then, you know, and I think he's got a point. You know, this is like we have suspended normalcy. We have suspended our normal reality, and now we're in a strange place, right? We're in this place that's sort of in between one thing and another. We're sort of waiting to see what's going to happen. We're not there and we're not here, right? We're sort of in the doorway between one room and another. And Sartre wrote after the war. Sartre, by the way, was in the French resistance to the Nazis. And he was a courier He carried secret messages, and he was involved in guerrilla actions against the Nazis. And, you know, this was serious. It was not like having to stay home from COVID. You know, basically, the German military occupied France. He said they controlled every aspect of our lives, including speech. You know, we couldn't go out and congregate. We couldn't meet to talk about things. And he said, you know, it was a total lockdown of the country. And then what he says is so interesting. He says, and we were never more free than we were then. We were never more free. Yeah, and I think that's a fascinating insight. In other words, you know, you couldn't go out, you couldn't congregate. If you criticized the Vichy government or the German occupation, you could be executed, and they were executing people. If you resisted, the Germans would go in and wipe out a whole village. If one person was involved in the resistance, they would just go kill everybody in that person's village. And Sartre said, we were never more free than we were then. Now, I think that that's another kind of like inconsistency that points to something interesting that we've papered over. You know, but Sartre's point, I think, was really, really fascinating, right? It's when we normally just go with everybody else. We do what everybody else is doing, and we do what we're supposed to do, right? We do what we're supposed to do. Sartre said suddenly that was no longer possible because, you know, first of all, you couldn't do what you were supposed to do, what people told you you have to do. But he said, but the other thing is, he said that anything we chose to do put us at risk, right? Put us at risk. So he said, instead of doing what we have always done, going with the flow, walking along with everybody else in lockstep, suddenly we had to ask ourselves, is this worth doing? Is this worth dying for? Dying for, you know? And he said, instead of killing life, instead of making it gray and drab, it had the opposite effect. He said, suddenly everything came alive. And I think this is a wonderful lesson, right? I mean, basically, it's true. You know, many people, you know, most of my students at Rutgers go to college because they're supposed to go to college, right? So, you know, you're 18, you're a middle-class person, you're supposed to go to college, right? And they go to college and they go through the motions, you know? But every once in a while, I'll meet a student who has like this burning desire to learn, right? You know, and you see it, you know? You'll come across a student and suddenly, you know, they're really like asking questions. They're thinking hard and they're not trying to get a grade. It's so clear that the grade isn't the issue. It's so clear that the issue is, you know, something is, they're responding to their surroundings with this energy and this curiosity. Right? And I don't think they're there to get a degree. I think they're there to explore, or they have questions they don't even understand fully, but they're trying to work them out. And I think that's what Sartre's talking about, right? It's like, you know, we don't know ourselves, our true selves, you know, because we live in this routine world of, you know, get up, you're 17, go to college. After college, you usually get a job and you get married. You have 1.7 children. You start putting away money for your retirement. And, you know, that's all okay. It's okay. But, you know, these mountains were not made for human foolishness. the way we live is more precious than that. It's bigger than that, right? And I've been married for 40 years, and I'm very happy that I got married. So I'm not criticizing marriage, I'm not criticizing college. But what I'm saying is that we tend to shrink the universe down to what we imagine is our reality, right? And, you know, Zen practice wants us to go in the other direction. It wants us to step out of our reality, our so-called reality, at least, you know, an hour a day or half a day on Saturdays, and realize that the universe is a lot bigger than this artificial world we've created and in which we worry so much about, right? It's like the big part of ourselves gets 1% of our time, and the small part of ourselves gets 99% of our time. And in most cases, it's not even 1%, you know. Most people, I would say, most people, I would say, are strangers to the big self, their big selves, right? Because they live in the world of the small self so exclusively. You know, we go through life doing what everybody else is doing, and we never ask ourselves, who am I? Who are we? Where do we come from, and where are we going? We never ask that question. Zen is all about asking that question. It's like, you know, when the Nazis took over and everything normal had to stop, people suddenly couldn't rely on the opinion of others. They had to decide for themselves, what is my life? And, in Zen too, you know, when Bodhidharma, Dhammo, came from India and sat in a cave for 9 years waiting for his first student to show up, his first student eventually showed up after 9 years and sat outside the mouth of a cave in the snow. And Bodhidharma didn't let him in and let him sit out in the snow for a day and a night. And then finally, this Chinese man, in Japanese he's called Shinko. Shinko cuts off his arm to show Bodhidharma that he's serious. And Bodhidharma in the koan says, you didn't have to cut off your arm. I just kept you out there because I'm searching for somebody who doesn't look to others for approval. Doesn't look to others for approval. See, we all go along with the, you know, even the Buddha, you know, actually the Buddha said, I go against the flow. I swim against the current. I swim against the current. So to practice Zen is to swim against the current. You know, you don't go with the flow, you swim against the current. You know, we practice, our koan practice is about finding the inconsistencies in this imaginary world and breaking it open. And when you break it open, you realize it's like behind that little shell is a vast universe. See? Behind the little shell is the vast universe. This is what we do again and again in our koan practice, right? We worry about all kinds of things. We wake up at night and, you know, I have a friend of mine who was in the book business, you know, and she said, you know, basically, if you decide to write a book, if you decide to be like a novelist, you know, you write your book in isolation, and the whole time you're writing it, you're miserable because you don't know if you'll get it published. You don't know if you can find an agent. So, you know, you're writing this book and you think, I don't know, should I even do this? Is it even going to work out? Will I ever find an agent? You write the book, you find an agent, but it's not the agent you wanted. So you're still unhappy because it's not the agent, not the top drawer agent, it's another agent. And then you're worried because you're thinking, is the book going to get published or not? You know, is the book going to get, am I going to find a publisher or not? And the agent actually finds a publisher, but it's not the publisher you want. It's like a third rate publisher instead of a, you know, Simon & Schuster, right? Or Random House. And then, the book, you found an agent, you got it published, and it's published. And then you worry about, did it sell enough, right? And then you worry about, you know, it's well reviewed, but was it well reviewed enough? And she said, so the author's never happy unless it, you know, wins the Nobel Prize or something. So, you know, all of us tend to live that way if we're not careful. We tend to make the world smaller and smaller. And, you know, what Zen does is to call attention to the artificiality of the world we've made. You know, I'm sure you've had this experience, something like this. Anyway, when I was at the university, I've talked about this a lot, but when I was at the University of Washington, I'll never forget, I went to this graduate class, and it was just dreadful, because we were talking about Heidegger. And Heidegger, if you've read him, if you had the pleasure of reading Mr. Heidegger, is a very difficult read. And, you know, I was in this graduate class with people who read the German Heidegger, not the English translation. And, you know, they were all very sophisticated. And I was just getting started in this game. And I felt, you know, I was so overwhelmed, I couldn't even open my mouth. Right? I thought anything I say is going to be too stupid to say. And I came out of that room just feeling devastated. And I was walking home, and in Seattle, you know, it's cloudy like 70% of the time. And the city of Seattle, there's just like a gray lid over the city. And then the winds come up and blow the clouds away. And every once in a while, you suddenly realize that Mount Rainier is right outside of Seattle. It's like it's gray clouds, and then one day, they blow away and you look and it's like having Mount Fuji outside your window. And I was walking home from this graduate class, and I was so depressed. And I looked up and I saw Mount Rainier. And it was like it blew it all away. It's like, who cares? You know, the world is bigger than this. This mountain wasn't made, my life wasn't made for human foolishness. Your life wasn't made for human foolishness, see? And it was so liberating. You could say, well, why did you feel better? Because it pulled the little world aside. It showed, took me out of the little world and it put me in the big world. And in that world, you know, you don't have a reason for existing. You don't have a reason for existing. You have no goals. You have nothing to do and nowhere to go. When I was young, I hitchhiked, you know? And hitchhiking, I love. I'm too old to hitchhike, and it's probably not safe anymore for people to hitchhike, but back when I was young, you could just go out on the on-ramp to the interstate and just stick out your thumb, and you could get a ride for 300 miles. And sometimes, I didn't care where it was going. I just wanted to go. And I can remember hitchhiking from Seattle down to Albuquerque, New Mexico, I was going right through Montana, right around the Tetons, and being stranded there for 4 hours, right? Trying to go south, and I was stranded. Nobody would pick me up for 4 hours. And, you know, it was glorious, right? I'm just standing out looking at the Teton Mountains. There was this body of water, and on the body of water there were nests. Cranes build their nests out of sticks on shallow water, so there are these mounds that come out of the shallow water, and that's their nest. And there were like 100 or 50 of those little nests. I'm standing there looking at these mountains, and it's like, who cares? You know, eventually I want to get picked up. But the view, you know, if I had been on schedule, if I had been on schedule, if I had been going the way I wanted to go, I never would have seen that. You know, so the fact that my schedule fell apart, the fact that I couldn't get a ride, you know, suddenly made all of this available to me, things I never dreamed of and had never seen before and have never seen again. So, you know, it's easy to get caught in the little world, in the human foolishness, right? And to worry about gain and loss, right and wrong. But, you know, every once in a while, you know, we sit down on the cushion and it all drops away. And we realize, you know, this world is much bigger than I thought. I'm much bigger than I thought. You know, not my personal self, but my participation in this life. You know, so I have respect for the book After the Enlightenment, The Laundry, but I think it's the other way around. If I may say so, I think we do the laundry so we can cultivate this perspective. You know, we do have to take, you have to clean the house, you have to vacuum, you have to clean the bathroom. I have to clean the bathroom pretty soon. But, you know, I'm not doing my meditation so I can clean the bathroom, if I may say so. It's important. We must have a clean bathroom. But actually, I'm taking care of these things so I can live in the bigger world, bigger world. And everybody benefits if you do that. You benefit, everybody benefits. You know, I'm sure you've had the experience of being worried about something and it's upsetting to you, it's upsetting the people around you. Then you get on your bicycle for the afternoon and you ride around along the canal along the Delaware River. And you come home and you realize it doesn't matter. And so you're more generous, you're kinder and compassionate to people. You realize that was unimportant. I got caught in the human foolishness. So, you know, actually being a better human requires us to be able to get out of our human limitations. And when we can be kind and generous and patient and not worry about things that are actually unimportant. So, lurking in the grasses, sticking to the trees, one turns into a ghost. See, if you get caught up in the small things, you will turn into a ghost. Being constrained and unjustly punished, being trapped by life and punished by life, those things don't exist. But when we imagine that we're caught or punished, we become, you know, one becomes a ghostly curse. When calling it, you burn paper money and present a horse. This is like, you know, basically making an offering to the gods, you could say, you know, trying sometimes to make sure somebody has money in the next world, right? As if there would be money in the next world, right? When repelling it, you curse water and write charms. You know, we're scheming to control the big universe. Okay. A monk said to Kaoshan, "How is it when the morning clothes are not worn? Let it all go. Let it all go. Let it all go. At least an hour a day on the cushion. Please let it all go." And Kaoshan said, a monk asked Kaoshan, "How is it when the morning clothes are not worn?" Kaoshan said, "Today, Kaoshan's filial duty is fulfilled." The monk said, "How about after the fulfillment of filial duty?" Kaoshan said, "Kaoshan likes to get falling down drunk. This world is my playground. This big world is my playground. Everywhere I turn is freedom." verse, the pure household has no neighbors. For long years, staying in, sweeping, not admitting any dust, right? Small, small, small. Where the light turns, tilts the moon, remaining at dawn. When the forms of the hexagrams are distinguished, that's from the I Ching. Then are established dawn and spring, having freshly fulfilled filial duty. Then one meets the spring. So, you know, clean up your house and then sit down on your cushion. Okay, take care of the details, but then do this and let them go and be with your big self. Walking drunk, singing crazily, turban hanging down, ambling with tousled hair, who cares? In great peace, with no concerns, a man falling down drunk.